Thank you, everyone, for coming. I gather my microphone works. We'll find out, Professor.
Mine does too.
Good. I'm Michael Green. I'm the Japan chair here at CSIS and associate professor at Georgetown. And thank you for coming. We're perfectly timed and perfectly staffed with Professor Jerry Curtis to look at the new Abe cabinet and analyze the legacy of Prime Minister Koizumi, the challenges and potential legacy of an Abe government, and what it means for the U.S.-Japan relationship. The last time we had a meeting here at CSIS to assess and begin predicting the post-Koizumi government, I introduced Len Schopa, my friend and professor at UVA, as the Jerry Curtis of his generation. And Len's a modest guy, and he said, no, that's a bit too much. But today I can say without fear of contradiction that we have the Jerry Curtis of his generation. As you all probably know, he received his PhD in 1968 from Columbia, worked closely with a member of the Japanese Diet. Probably everyone in this room has read his book on Japanese electioneering. I actually was so impressed by it as a graduate student at SAIS under Nat Thayer that I went and found the original dissertation and read that too. The subsequent books on Japanese politics are the must-have compass for understanding what's happening in Japan. We're going to do this in a kind of informal dialogue style today. I don't know if you've seen this TV show, The Actor's Studio, but I even grew the beard to play the part of the questioner. I forgot the note cards, though. We'll have a bit of a dialogue, and then I think we'll open it up for questions. But the first thing I'd like to ask Professor Curtis, before we move forward to looking at Abe-san, is how you would assess the Koizumi legacy, both in terms of policy, but also what he's done to politics in Japan.
Good. Well, first, I want to say hello to a lot of old friends here in the audience, and it's a great opportunity for me to come down here and have a chance to chat with Mike in front of everybody and see where we agree and disagree on what's happening in Japan these days, and to hear your questions. So,
can you move your mic up a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Where is it? Oh, it's down the end. Where is my mic?
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, folks. So this is not quite the Actor's Studio after all.
That's it.
All right. So first about Koizumi's legacy, as the first question, it's very important in a number of respects because it sets the stage for talking about the challenges that face Mr. Abe. I think I have a piece, by the way, I don't know if you saw it in Newsweek a couple of weeks ago on Koizumi's legacy. And leave it to the editors of magazines to come up with great titles. The title wasn't mine, but one of the editors of Newsweek read my piece and liked it and said, I got the right title. It's Elvis Has Left the Building. And then he said, is it okay if we identify you as Jerry Curtis instead of Gerald Curtis? Because with that title, somehow the Gerald Curtis, Elvis Has Left the Building, doesn't quite get it. So in that article, I'm Jerry Curtis, Elvis Has Left the Building. Elvis Has Left the Building. That style of politics, that charisma, that charm, that ability to make the public believe that if they go along with this leader, things will be okay. That was Koizumi. That cannot be Mr. Abe. Mr. Abe cannot emulate Koizumi's style. Gordon Brown will not be able to be Tony Blair. George Bush could not be Bill Clinton in terms of style. That Blair, Clinton, Koizumi kind of charisma is something that cannot be copied. So that's a big question for Mr. Abe. What do you do if you can't be Koizumi? And I'll come back to that in a minute. I think Koizumi's most important legacy was that he made Japanese feel optimistic about the future. He made people feel good about their leader. They have a cool leader. The world pays him a lot of attention. He's developed this very special relationship with the president of the most powerful country and Japan's most, by far most important partner, the United States, relationship with George Bush. And Koizumi, you know, told the public, look, if we do some, take some risks, make some big changes, things are really going to be good. And after 15 years of kind of in this recession, deflation, being down in the dumps, nothing works, playing on the margins like in the Hashimoto period with reform, throwing government money out in public works and so on. It didn't work, and Koizumi said, believe me, we can do it differently and it'll work. They believed him. That was his greatest accomplishment. You know, and then there are specific things like bank forcing a resolution of this overhang of bad debt in the banks, privatization of the postal office and so on. And his other big legacy is that he has left a huge, huge problem for Mr. Abe in terms of relations with Japan's neighbors. It's a huge problem. And we'll have plenty of time, I'm sure, this morning to talk about this China relationship. And it's the China relationship. It's not the Korea relationship. I think that is manageable. But it's the China relationship. And it's this historical memory issue as part of the problem of the China relationship. And that problem got a lot worse over the 5 years of the Koizumi regime. So he's left this legacy of optimism. He's left a legacy of charismatic leadership. He's left a very important legacy, which Abe wants to try to continue, of centering the policymaking process in the prime minister's office. Mm-hmm. This was set up by Hashimoto. The reform was set up by Hashimoto. But, you know, those reforms kicked in February of 2001, only 2 or 3 months before Koizumi became prime minister. So he's the first prime minister to actually breathe life into the Economic and Fiscal Policy Council and this whole new structure in the Kante, in the prime minister's office. And the problem is this. In political science, we talk a lot about structural change, structural evolution. Structures, the formal rules of the game, mean a lot. But it's the people who breathe life into the formal structure. Koizumi gave total backing to Takenaka on pushing economic reform and using the Council on Economic and Fiscal Policy as a framework for constraining the bureaucracy, for setting the priorities, setting the parameters of policy and so on. When you have a change of people, it may not work like that. We already saw Ando Yosano, the last head of this council under Koizumi, the bureaucrats were back pretty much in charge. So how does Abe do it? How will he center more power in the Kante? He wants to create an NSC to handle these foreign policy issues. Well, lots of luck is my attitude, frankly, but we come back to this issue. So I think the legacy in that sense is very positive in terms of the Japanese feeling better about the future. You know, they've had, this is the best period of economic growth in a couple of decades. The big problems of bank debt, deflation, pretty much looks like deflation. They haven't declared a victory yet, but it looks like deflation is pretty much under control. So forth and so on. That's all positive, but it leads to real issues for Abe about how he does it differently and retains public support. And so let me just make one comment on this, and then I'll stop and we'll get back to make this into a dialogue rather than a speech. But Abe cannot do a Koizumi. He can grow his hair to his shoulders and croon Love Me Tender, but it won't work. He cannot get public support by style. He has to get it by substance. Koizumi used his style to get public support that then enabled him to push through policies that the party didn't want to see happen. Abe has to turn it around. He has to use his policies to sustain his public support. He's at 65, 70% or something of public support. It's very thin. This is a wait-and-see attitude. Mm-hmm. People are giving him the benefit of the doubt. But if he doesn't come up with some policies, we know he has attitude, but we don't know that he has much in the way of policies. If he doesn't come up with policies, his popularity will sink very, very fast.
Excellent. Thank you. I had a chance, of course, to see Koizumi and the president in action, and also to see Abe in action with principals on our side like Rice or Hadley or the vice president. And I think it's a fair bet that Abe will not sing Elvis Presley or quote from High Noon in any of his meetings, but he does have the advantage, perhaps even more than Koizumi, that he's a policy wonk and can talk strategy and so forth. So I can picture that piece of what Koizumi had, a good relationship with the U.S., maybe not as much flash, but I think with some good substance and a lot of respect for him here. He was Deputy Chief Cabinet Secretary during 9/11 in Iraq and then Chief Cabinet Secretary, so he has working relationships. So that one piece is probably okay, but he, of course, has an upper house election coming up next summer. That's where most people think he could be in trouble first, and he has an agenda to choose from. He's got, as you mentioned, China. My sense from, we were both in Japan last week, my sense is that he's going to move on China first, not the U.S., but we'll see. He's got education reform bill. There's the Okinawa transformation. If you were advising Abe-san, and I don't know which TV camera this is, but maybe in a way you are through the media, you know, what would you, to get through July and to keep that support rate from collapsing, what do you think he has to deliver over the next 9 months?
So the first point is that he is going to face a very tough election next summer because, you know, this upper house, it's elected, the members are elected, half of the members every 3 years for six-year terms. So the term of the members that is expiring next July were elected in July of 2001. July of 2001, 3 months after Mr. Koizumi became prime minister, popularity rating close to 90%. The party did much better in 2001 than it had expected to do because of this Koizumi boom. So under the best circumstances, it's not going to do as well, most likely. And under the worst circumstances, it'll do really bad. And if the Kometo and the LDP together lose a majority in the upper house, you will see this kind of Abe Oroshi, you know, let's dump Abe movement grow very strong. The problem that Abe faces by having had no real contest to become president of the LDP is that everybody jumped on his bandwagon. Virtually everybody jumped on his bandwagon. In the end, like 65, 66% of the votes were for Abe. He's lucky he didn't even get a bigger share. He would have been much better off if Fukuda had entered the race and it had been really tight and the press had pressed Abe to take strong positions on specific issues. And so he came in as prime minister with the public really interested in the campaign, interested in him, having a clear sense of what he wanted to do. But it didn't work out that way. The problem is when everybody jumps on the Abe bandwagon is that if something goes wrong, the same people start jumping on Abe. And that's what he has to worry about. Now, he has two things that he can do in preparation for that upper house election to try to win it. One, and this is my preferred scenario, one is that he picks a few key domestic issues that the public is worried about, concerned about, and wants to see action taken on, and that he takes a courageous stance so that he creates this image of a man who's not afraid to do something that some people might not like, but that he thinks is right. And that includes educational reform, not this Kyoiku Kihonho fundamental law in education about patriotism and so on, but what do you do to try to reverse the deterioration in the compulsory school education, primary, middle school, particularly in urban Japan, that occurred in the 1990s. He is very interested in this issue, and I've spoken with him about this issue, but he doesn't have clear policies on it. Medical insurance. You know, the American model is very popular among the conservatives in Japan today, and my advice is there are things that you know that are worth emulating in the way the U.S. does things, but the one thing you don't want to do is emulate the U.S. healthcare system. You know, the Japanese spend the equivalent of 8% of GDP on healthcare, and there's universal healthcare insurance. And the Americans, we spend 14% of GDP on healthcare, and we got 45 million people without any insurance. There are problems with the Japanese system. You know, 10, 15 years ago, you paid 10% copay when you went to the doctor or to the hospital. Now you pay 30%. And since they're all afraid to raise taxes, they're trying to find other ways to make it more expensive for the consumers in the healthcare system. But dealing with this issue of healthcare, aging society, kaigo hoken, education, if he, you know, you read his initial policy speech in the Diet, the Shoshenzetsu, there is nothing there in terms of policy. There's virtually nothing there. It's all generalities, all platitudes, all attitude. Well, if he doesn't breathe some substance, policy substance, into these attitudes and in general, you know, sight challenge and all this stuff, I think his popularity, as I said, will decline. He'll be in real trouble. The alternative to coming up with specific policies on these very difficult, contentious domestic issues is to play a nationalist card and to be the man who has Japan standing tall, saying what it thinks. You know, my view is that he becomes prime minister, he's become prime minister at a time that three eras have ended simultaneously in Japan. And he has to have a strategy to take Japan into the new era. 5.5 years of a unique political era cannot be copied. 15 years of deflation. Now you have economic growth back, but you got new issues on the agenda. Inequality issues. How do you sustain growth? How do you deal with the fiscal deficit? And then the third is the end of 50 years of Japanese timidity on the international political stage. It's over. And you know, the Japanese submission of that resolution to the UN Security Council calling for invoking Charter 7 put sanctions on North Korea, that is symbolic. The age of the 50 years of Japanese timidity in international politics is over. That's perfectly logical that it should be over. But if you don't have a strategy for what a not timid Japan does, and you just have an attitude that now we're going to stand up tall, you're asking for lots and lots of trouble. And my concern about Abe is I do not see the strategy. And the danger is that you play the attitude. You play the nationalist card. And so and this all relates to China policy. My sense, my conviction is that we're heading into a honeymoon period in Sino-Japanese relations. And the press will be writing, both in Japan and overseas, over the next 2 to 3 months, what a surprise it is that Abe is so positive about China relations. He almost certainly will meet Hu Jintao on the sidelines of the APEC summit in Vietnam. I would imagine, I'd be surprised, frankly, if he does not announce an expanded program of cultural exchange, of increased fellowships for Chinese students, and talk a lot about China relations. And this will work because the Chinese have been busily sending signals to Japan that now that Koizumi is gone, they want to use this change of regime in Japan to get out of this dead-end street they got into by refusing to meet with the Prime Minister of Japan. So they're looking for an opportunity to have a good relationship with Abe. So I think from now until next spring, things are going to be pretty good in Sino-Japanese relations. And then the history issue will come back to bite Mr. Abe. He has to make a very tough decision about going to Yasukuni and about the history issue. And my view on the history issue is that it is not possible to draw a national boundary around the issue of historical memory. You cannot do that. And if he fools himself into thinking that as long as he makes it clear to China and to Korea and to everybody else that how a country remembers history is its own business and nobody else's, if he thinks that that will go down, well, that will go over and other countries will accept it, he is going to be in big, big trouble. You cannot draw national boundaries around historical memory. And there's a very interesting analog in American-Japanese relations on this point, which is worth remembering. In 1994, the U.S. Postal Service decided to issue a number of commemorative stamps commemorating the end of the Second World War. And one of the stamps that the Postal Office had prepared had a picture of a mushroom cloud with a statement with the caption saying, "A bomb hastens war's end." And the Japanese government protested and said that issuing that stamp would be affront to the sensibilities of the Japanese people. And the Japanese government was right to protest. You cannot draw national boundaries around the historical memory of the dropping of the A-bomb on Japan any more than Japan could draw a national boundary about its aggression in China. So I think that this history issue cannot be swept under the rug. It cannot be avoided. I think the Chinese will not push this issue for the next 6 months. You know, Prime Minister Koizumi, after his initial campaign commitment to visit Yasukuni, never once said that he would visit Yasukuni in the 5 years he was prime minister. He said he would deal with it in an appropriate fashion. Mr. Abe is using the same language. The Chinese will want to believe that means he will not visit Yasukuni, just as Hu Jintao wanted to believe after the APEC summit in San Diego that Koizumi would not visit Yasukuni. And Abe may well believe that the Chinese understand that that means that he probably will visit Yasukuni. So without getting into, I'm kind of Yasukuni'd out, frankly. I was in a symposium in Tokyo last week on Yasukuni. It's a mess of an issue, and it's a very sad thing because that should be a very quiet, sacred place where people can go and live with their memories, and it's not. It's a politicized shrine that's trying to propagate a message that glorifies Japanese behavior in the Second World War. As long as what the shrine's priests are doing, it is not possible to tell other countries not to be concerned. How does Abe deal with this? He's not going to deal with it for the next 6 months. That's why you're going to have a honeymoon in Chinese-Japanese relations. He will have to deal with it next spring. The honeymoon is over.
Fascinating. I'd like to pick up on two things in what you just went over. First, on the attitude versus strategy. I agree with you. The attitude alone is not going to carry the Japanese public. It's going to resonate badly in Washington or in the region. But I do think Abe-san has a strategy, and I think in some ways that's what distinguishes him from Prime Minister Koizumi, who with the U.S.-Japan alliance really went on instinct. I think Abe is more of a kind of realpolitik, almost Mackinder-like strategic thinker, an Alfred Thayer Mahan of his generation, if you will. And I wouldn't be surprised to see over the next 6 months, in addition to this honeymoon with China, and I agree, a very clear strengthening of ties, including even in the security dimension, with Australia and probably with India. Manmohan Singh goes in December and John Howard just before that. So I'd be curious on your reaction to that. In other words, he's playing a power game with China, and it's going to be, I think, explicit at the same time he's putting out a hand of friendship. And I think that probably will play reasonably well back here. The other thing is, I agree with you, Abe is being vague on Yasukuni. I think the Chinese know that they don't know whether or not he'll go to Yasukuni. They did think that teksetsuno handan, that, you know, I'll do the appropriate thing, meant he wouldn't go, and the Chinese foreign ministry said so publicly. And it reminded me of the Nixon Sato Zensho Shimasu, I'll look into it, statement in the 3 decades ago. But I think now the Chinese are taking a risk. What do you think about the Abe strategy? Do you agree there is something there, or if there is, I suppose it's not clearly articulated and it's hard to know. And secondly, if he doesn't go to Yasukuni, if he decides not to go, or if he modifies the way he goes, is there a way out of this? Is there a win-win way out? And this will be the last Yasukuni question for me anyway, because I know you're Yasukuni'd out. But is there a win-win way out where he encourages changing the museum, he visits privately like he did in April? Is there a way to save face for both Japan and China on that one so that it doesn't become a big disaster after this honeymoon period?
Okay, so on the first point about does he have a strategy as well as an attitude, my answer is I don't know. I'm not sure. My impressions from talking with him and listening to him is that leaves me dubious. The idea that Japan can, in a sense, balance China by strengthening its ties with other democracies in the Asia Pacific, especially India and Australia. That makes a lot of sense for Japan to strengthen its ties with India and with Australia, but especially with India, for lots of reasons, including economic reasons and so forth and so on. But, you know, India has been very busy improving its relations with China. India is not about to sort of work with Japan to somehow balance China. The idea that that's an option for Japan seems to me to be very naive. So if the strategy is somehow you can avoid making very hard decisions about that would aim at improving relations with China by improving relations with other countries that would balance China, I think that is not a strategy. I just think that's a mistake. And on Yasukuni, you know, there are lots of proposals to how to deal with this issue, from moving, you know, disenshrining the 14 Class A war criminals to creating an alternative site. There's only one real solution. There are two ways to deal with Yasukuni. One way is to solve the problem, and the other is to somehow avoid solving the problem. The way to solve the problem is very simple. That is, you depoliticize Yasukuni. The museum is moved off the premises. It's not just the museum. When I visited Yasukuni 3 years ago, I've been several times since, but when I went 3 years ago, I went and paid my respects at the inner shrine, went in and prayed. And you're taken in by the priests with a group of people who gather there. And in the, you know, machiaisutsu, in the waiting room, waiting to go into the shrine, there's a TV camera and it shows a movie about the Tokyo War Crimes trial. And how, you know, how outrageous it was. This is not in the museum. This is in the inner shrine, in the Honden. So depoliticizing the shrine, this is what Prime Minister Nakasone and others have quietly been advocating. That would be a great solution. I mean, that's a real solution, because neither the Chinese or anybody else has any argument with the fact that people go and pay respects to those who died in the war. That's not what this is about. And the alternative is probably, I'm not sure if this is realistic, but I'm sure Abe is trying to feel the Chinese out, whether there is some compromise. He goes to Yasukuni. It's like what happened before Koizumi. After Nakasone, several of the prime ministers went to Yasukuni, and I think there was an implicit understanding. The prime minister would go once. The Chinese would protest once. Business would go on as usual. So if a deal could be struck where next year Abe goes, maybe without any advance notice, like he did this past April, the next day Mr. Shiozaki, the chief cabinet secretary, issues a statement that the prime minister visited Yasukuni. At the same time, issues a danwa, kind of a statement from the prime minister about the importance he attaches to China relations and regret over the past and all that stuff. Yeah, maybe. There's an outside chance because the Chinese don't want to have a bad relationship with Japan for the near-term future at least. But, so this is my final word on Yasukuni. If Abe does not find a way to avoid having this become the reason why Sino-Japanese relations are seen to be deteriorating, it will hurt Japan's relations with the United States. The U.S. wants a strong alliance with Japan and a good relationship with China. And if the reason is that we can't have, if the reason we cannot have both is because Japan is creating problems over this history issue and basically supporting the Yasukuni view that the attack on Pearl Harbor was a preemptive act of self-defense, this will not go over well in Washington, as we already know. So the danger of this issue and of the history issue more broadly is not that it will only adversely affect Sino-Japanese relations, but that, as I said, if the Sino-Japanese relationship is seen to get bad because of the history issue, it will badly affect Japan's relations with the U.S. If the Sino-Japanese relationship is seen to get bad because the Chinese are being unreasonable over the development of energy resources in the East China Sea, over the Senkaku Islands, over other issues that are real issues in the Sino-Japanese relation, then that will make life very difficult for China with the Americans and will reinforce the Japanese-American alliance. A lot depends on how Abe handles this issue.
It will be interesting to see. I detect more flexibility on the specifics with both Abe-san and with the Chinese leadership. So it will be interesting to see, and maybe we'll have you back in the spring to assess whether they pulled it off.
Yeah, I don't want to say that I think it's necessarily going to be the case that relations will get worse. I don't believe that. I think they might get better. I think both countries really want to try to improve this relationship. I hope Abe is realistic about what is possible and what isn't. And then, you know, and that the Chinese are as well. I think one thing about the Chinese, I've been spending quite a bit more time in China. Now I spent half a year based in Tokyo, so I've been going to China a lot in the last year or two. And what impresses me about China now is that they seem to have learned that they made a big mistake, that they thought that Gaiatsu works for them with the Japanese, and that if they simply use this pressure against Japan, that Japan would give in. And they picked the wrong guy with Koizumi, and I think they know that they have the wrong guy with Abe. Because Abe's main point about Yasukuni is that if we give in on Yasukuni, that'll only convince the Chinese that we're going to give in on all these other issues. So the Chinese have backed off from this overt, heavy-handed foreign pressure, and are looking for, and I think have become much more subtle in the dealing with Japan just in the past 6 months.
Yeah, I agree. The Chinese should have read the Armitage Report, which said clearly the age of Gaiatsu is over, but I think they read it for other reasons.
I think that's exactly right. The Americans at least figured out around 2000 that Gaiatsu was going to be counterproductive and there'd be a different way to deal with Japan. That was the strategic dialogue. You know, why everybody says the Armitage Report, I always tell I say it when I give talks in Japan, people forget, and Japanese probably most of them never knew, that it was not called the Armitage Report.
Right.
It was the Armitage Nye
exactly.
Report. And if Al Gore had won the election and Joe Nye sat in the seat that Armitage sat in, everybody in Japan would have been saying, how amazing that the Democratic Party changed so much in its position towards Japan, because there was a bipartisan consensus that emerged by the early 2000s that Gaiatsu no longer worked. That's why this change is not because of the Bush administration. Yeah. This is a structural change in the way America deals with Japan. That's a very healthy, very positive development, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Before we open it up, let me ask if you could address two things. One, how do you assess the team Abe has assembled in the cabinet? And we've talked about all his difficulties, but what potential does he have to leave a legacy of constitutional revision or some of the other things he's talked about?
Well, on the cabinet and the key party posts taken as a group, I have several impressions. One is in a strange way is a positive assessment, in that it's a boring cabinet. What I mean by that is that I think that's a good sign that he understands he cannot play the game of trying to be a kakui prime minister, of having some razzle-dazzle, wow the public with who he appointed to the cabinet. He didn't. There's only one non-diet member, Ota Hiroko, who's a good friend of mine, and she's very competent. But she's not. She ain't no Takenaka, and she has no political clout, and so that's not a major appointment. So in a sense, it's kind of a sober group of people, a serious group of people, who I think were chosen mainly because Abe feels comfortable with them, and that most of them. Not all of them, but most of them share his ideological views. I was surprised that he felt he had to reward people who came out early to support him, because some of the appointments, it's hard to figure out why he would make them, except as that it was a payback for support. But since everybody supported him, he didn't need to do that. Now, I think his economic team, frankly, is not very impressive, or it's not clear what the thrust of it that the team as such doesn't have a view. You have Ota Hiroko, head of this council on fiscal economic policy. She's a good economic analyst. She staffed that council for Takenaka. She's a Takenaka loyalist. She believes in what he did. So she'll be a voice there, but she's not the kind of person who's going to really take on the bureaucrats. Yamamoto Yuji, the guy at the FSA, you know, this is all new for him. This economic stuff. And Omi Koji, I thought, was a big surprise. I mean, this is the guy who said in the late 90s, you know, the Japanese economy will bloom with the cherry blossoms. He just didn't say it would be the cherry blossoms blooming 10 years later. and his main claim to fame is on science. He spent a lot of time. He's very thoughtful about science and technology issues. And the other person in the cabinet doesn't have direct economic responsibilities, of course, is in the key role, is Mr. Shiozaki, former BOJ man in the Kante as chief cabinet secretary. And I think that's very important, because Abe doesn't have any experience dealing with economic issues, and I think he wanted someone who he really trusted and is loyal. And Shiozaki signed on with Abe very early on in the game. They came here together, Golden Week last year, and so on. I think he wanted someone at his right hand who could be his guide, tutor, advisor, and so on the economic issues. And that's Shiozaki. And by the way, I think he put the North Korean abductee issue in Shiozaki's hands, basically because he wants to run it himself. And so keeping that right next to him with Shiozaki. So the economic team, this isn't like Koizumi giving full backing to someone like Takenaka. And it makes you wonder how much emphasis Abe is going to put on these economic issues. I don't believe, as some others do, that now it's okay. Japan can sort of go on autopilot on the economic issues, and things will be okay. He's going to put off this consumption tax issue until after the upper house election. But He has to face that issue at one point. And my view on this one, you know, I've come to the I've conclusion, what is the reason for a big budget deficit in Japan? I think it's very simple. You don't be an economist to understand it. Japanese like to have the social services and other public government services that you find in Western Europe, in Germany and France and elsewhere. And they want to pay the kind of taxes that we pay in the United States. The gap is the budget deficit. And Koizumi eliminated a lot of the waste in spending. But now you cannot further cut the budget without cutting into the bone of these programs that the public likes. I think, this getting back to your earlier point, advice to Abe, a courageous Abe would go to the public and say, some of these programs, medical care, kaigo hoken, investment in education and so on, we can't continue to do that with this tax structure. We need to earmark 3, 4, 5 additional points of the consumption tax to maintain and strengthen these systems. You have a choice. You want to keep the consumption tax at 5% and cut back on the services, or you want to keep the services and raise the tax. My guess, Japanese will opt for the tax increase if they're convinced that there isn't a lot of money being wasted. Anyway, that's the economic team. On the foreign policy team, I think it's very right of center, very hawkish, with Nakayama Shohei in the you know, in the head of the Policy Affairs Research Council, and Asotaro. And though it's not security policy, one of the appointments that really stunned me, I can't understand it, is the agriculture ministry going to Mr. Matsuoka, who is considered to be the don of the agriculture lobby. WTO, FTA negotiations. Either he's going to do a Nixon goes to Beijing trick and bring the agricultural lobby along for liberalization because he has that confidence as being the key agricultural lobbyist in the LDP, or he's going to throw a monkey wrench into all the efforts of media and other agencies in the Japanese government to form these to strengthen the WTO and form the FTA. So the cabinet doesn't strike me. By the way, the other big person on the economic issues is Nakagawa Hidenao, you know, the Secretary General. But you know, the Secretary General, he got a lot of other things on his plate. So I don't think he's going to be the central player that some of the newspaper reports have. I don't think this cabinet gives us a very good idea of where things are going to go, and it raises. So I repeat my concern. I don't have a conclusion about Mr. Abe's government. I really hope he's successful. But my concern is that it will drift, it will float. There'll be a lot of attitude, a lot of generalities, a lot of talk of constitutional revision, but he can stay in office for the next 5 years. The Constitution is not going to be revised. He wants to revise the whole thing. That be enough to take just one piece of it, Article 9 or something else. Even getting that done in the next 3 to 5 years would be very difficult. The whole thing, it's not going to happen. So there's a lot of, he's throwing a lot out there that is not going to be manifested in real policy. And a year from now, come the upper house election, and people say, what did you do for me, Mr. Abe? And if the answer is, not very much, except to try to make me feel good about my country, I don't think that's going to win election for him.
Let's open it up. And I guess maybe I'll call on people. And if you could, Professor Curtis probably knows most people here, but if you could say who you are and where you're from. Yes, Mr. Green.
Very much. I'd like to thank you both for a very illuminating dialogue. Jerry, you have always very insightful and clear things to say. I think you need to come to Washington more often. I did want to ask on the subject of foreign policy. From what one reads in the newspaper, there seems to be some continuity in that Mr. Okazaki has been an influential advisor to Mr. Koizumi and also apparently to Mr. Abe. And however controversial he may be, he is also, I think, someone usually viewed as a strategic thinker. I wonder if you would offer some observations on his role. I would appreciate it.
Well, I don't know what kind of role Okazaki now will play, if any, in the government. I think he's been kind of a tutor to Abe. I mean, I don't think Okazaki was very influential with Koizumi, frankly. I'd be that's not my impression. I don't know. But let me answer the question by evading it and giving this answer. One of the concerns about Abe's foreign policy is whether he brings in a team of advisors, staff, that have a broad view of the world and of Japanese interests in it, and not a narrow tunnel vision that focuses on U.S. on relations with the United States. He needs to have people who see the region and see the global context for Japanese policy. And I think Okazaki is a strategic thinker, and I think he's very much in that camp that is focused almost exclusively on the U.S. alliance. No one questions that that's the most important relationship for Japan. But I hope he brings in, it would be very not be desirable for an American point of view for all the key advisors to the prime minister to be people who are very well informed on the U.S. and not much on anything on the rest of the world. That's not desirable. And so now we have Ms. Koike heading up this will emerge as kind of this National Security Council in the prime minister's office. But how it's staffed and what it does and how it relates to the foreign ministry and how Mr. Aso as foreign minister deals with this potential competitor for control over foreign policy. You know, there's a lot of kind of naive or half-baked understanding of how things work in the United States, including how the NSC works in the United States in Japan. And after all, it's not a presidential system. It's a parliamentary system. One of the curious, unfortunate consequences of recent generations of Japanese politicians and intellectuals getting their higher education, postgraduate education, almost exclusively in the United States, is that unlike when I was in Japan 30 years ago and so many people really well-informed on European affairs, today you find very few Japanese who know much about how things are done in Europe, in Germany or in France, maybe a little bit of England, but you know, ten down the street is not organized like the White House, and there's a lot that Japan actually could gain from closely looking at the way, particularly Germany and some other continental European countries, manage the relationship between the prime minister or the chancellor and the parliament and so on. But so
you'll be encouraged to know, Carl, last week when I was in Japan, Kurt Campbell and I sat down with some of the people working on this new NSC concept and described our experiences in the Bush NSC and the Clinton NSC. And at the end, one of them stood up and said, "We better study Britain." and I think it'll end up being a hybrid. The NSC letters will definitely be on it, but Japan's a parliamentary system. I think they'll have to look.
But Mike, just on that, this is part of the problem, part of the concern about Abe. Here he's prime minister. He knew he was going to be prime minister. More 6 months ago, a year ago, he knew he was going to be prime minister. He didn't have to worry about the election campaign. He should have had you and Kurt Campbell over a year ago and had to meet with his staff to figure out how you structure an NSC so that when he became prime minister, he'd be able to do it. If he's first going to start studying the issue now, how long will it be before it kicks into place? Quite a while. That's why you have to wonder whether there's much that's going to happen over the next year.
True. Just to clarify, this wasn't with Abe.
I understand.
Who actually has, from his chief cabinet experience and deputy chief cabinet experience, an intense dialogue over the years with Rice and Hadley and Crouch and others. So I think he but his team is definitely new to the idea. Chris.
Thanks very much. Chris Nelson, The Nelson Report. Just got back from 3 days in South Korea and 6 days in China with my daughter. Great stuff. Her first trip to Asia, as you can imagine. Everything you said about Yasukuni, absolutely, completely agree. Everything you said about patching up China relations, absolutely. The Chinese have been showing, you know, for the last year or so, they understand this is dysfunctional, et cetera, et cetera. But, and now this is going to sound nasty, I don't mean it personally, I wish you wouldn't talk about the Korea the way you do. It drives me crazy. It's how all Japan types tend to talk about Korea. Oh, we can take care of that. Let me tell you something. You can't take care of it with that attitude. The Korean mistrust of everything Japanese is fundamental, visceral, in their bones. Okay. And, you know, they just don't trust anything that happens. And we need to deal with this and not say, oh, yeah, we're going to take care of China, and also Korea. You know, it ain't going to work that way. So I know you don't mean it that way, but stop saying it because it's going to blow up in our faces. They've got some missionary work that is beyond belief that has to be carried out there.
Well, let me just emphasize what I thought I said, which is that Prime Minister Abe does not consider the Korean relationship to be such a big problem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's what I said.
Okay.
His view is that Korea is a democracy. Korea has a mass media that, you know, creates problems like mass medias do in democracies, but that, and there are problems, and there's this anti-Jap, you know, this history of occupation and so forth and so on. But his view, whether he is right, wrong, naive, or sophisticated, is that this is a manageable issue, and he's relatively optimistic about Korea relations, whereas I wouldn't say he's pessimistic, but he's much more perplexed as to what the right strategy is to deal with China, and doesn't have the same confidence that he knows how to deal with China to make the relationship better that he does, for rightly or wrongly, about Japan. By the way, this is somewhat related. Oh, anyway, the thought comes to mind. One of Abe's sources of popularity that you will see grow in the coming months is his wife. She is a very, very telegenic, attractive. I don't know her personally, but... But this is going to be a terrific asset for Prime Minister Abe. And Abe's wife and her, and I remember Abe telling me this sometime last year whenever I was chatting with him. His wife and her girlfriends, they're constantly on the shuttle to Seoul. I think his wife has been studying Korean. Mm-hmm. She goes there a lot. You know, these obitarian Japanese middle-aged women who...
She's not an obitarian for the
yeah,
record.
That's not, I better take that back, yeah.
Just but, for the record.
You know, these Japanese middle-aged women who, you know, they love these Korean melodramas. They know the names of all the actors and actresses and so on. There's a very positive role she's going to play. Yeah. And in this relationship, I bet you she plays... at least an indirect role in showing that Abe really is kind of, you know, wants to have a good relationship, his family has a good relationship, and so on and so forth. And on the Korean relationship, more generally, yes, it's very difficult relationship. But don't forget, the Koreans have survived for hundreds and hundreds of years by balancing the big powers around them. They're not going to jump completely into the Chinese camp. There is no way that's going to happen, I don't believe. And when No Myung is gone, and the new administration comes in Seoul, you will see an effort on the part of the government in Korea to improve its relations with Japan. And you will see an effort on the part of Japan to improve its relations with Korea. So I wouldn't deny, Chris, that this is a very difficult relationship. But there are so many positive things going on in Japanese-Korean relations, especially at the popular level. Attitudes towards Korea and Japan are simply are so hugely different from what they were 20, 30 years ago. And, you know, Korean soft power in Japan, Japanese soft power in Korea, and so forth and so on. So, yeah, it's a difficult relationship. Prime Minister Abe thinks it's manageable and that things can get better. And at the popular level, there's a lot of very positive things going on. So we shouldn't be naive and assume things, you know, are going to be easy. No. But we shouldn't jump to the other conclusion and say that it's hopeless. No.
Do you think it's part of his calculation that with rapprochement visible between Japan and China, Korea will start to fall into place? In other words, it's not that he's forgotten Korea, but that the China piece, if it moves, might start to make the Korean piece move without as much effort on the Japanese side. Even in the phone call that No Myung and Abe had, they, according to the press, agreed they would try to meet in APEC and so forth. I just want to get clarification. Or do you think it's really just that he thinks it's not a problem and that China takes more effort?
No, I don't think that it's not a problem, but I think I know I don't know if this is him or me speaking at this point, but I think it's a very separate problem.
Yeah.
And improvement of relations with China, that generally improves the environment, and that's good for relations with Korea as well. But I don't think there's any any direct impact of an improvement of China relations on Japan relations. You know, and to mention the word again, the Yasukuni issue is not as important an issue in relations with Korea. It doesn't evoke the same emotions in Korea, because Korea was a colony of Japan. Korean soldiers fought as Japanese soldiers. There are over 20,000 Korean soldiers enshrined at Yasukuni. There are other issues. If you want to say what is the most emotional issue for Koreans on the Japan relationship, it's not Yasukuni. It's Dokdo. It's Takeshima, a symbol of the Japanese occupation of Korea. That's kind of where it started from the Korean point of view. So it's a different set of issues for Korea and Japan. Yeah, improvement in Sino-Japanese relations, very important for improving the environment generally, very important for avoiding potential problems in Japanese-American relations, and for setting a good kind of environment for improvement of Korea-Japan relations, but the issues are different.
I'm looking for someone from the Ayako.
Thank you, Ayako Doi. I'm nobody these days.
Come on.
Anyway, what strikes me in observing debate in Japan and also listening to people who come from Japan is the difference or the gap in the perception of where Japan is in terms of where Japan is in the world, in the region, foreign policy issues. I'm talking about nationalism, the right wing, you know, the leaning towards right, and so on. You know, here in Washington, at least, a lot of Japan watchers are worried about the direction Japan seems to be going in terms of anti-China, sort of excessive expression of nationalism, quashing the dissent, even at the foreign ministry, well, I don't know whether it's even or not, but then anyway, the Tamamoto affair and so on. Listening to the people who live in Japan, who operate in Japan, there seem to be a lack of sense of alarm about where Japan is going. And you know, it's almost as if that they live in a bubble, and everybody outside is worried about where the bubble is floating, but they're not the people inside, kind of thing. I mean, you go back and forth often, so what is your sense, and are we too alarmist about where Japan is going here in the U.S.?
Well, I think you said it. I go back and forth. And I go back and forth on this issue, but I think that Prime Minister Abe is in office next 3 years. How much different will Japanese security policy be 3 years from now than it is today? It'll be a little different. There'll be incremental change. Will there be a discontinuity, a break? Will Japan become a so-called normal country that uses military power as a tool of its foreign policy like other countries do, project force far from Japanese shores, eliminate the restrictions on Japanese participation in the role of Japanese military forces overseas? No, it's not going to happen. The change is going to be incremental. Abe will take Japan more to the right of center. But in the global scheme of things, the right of center in Japan isn't very right compared to other countries in the world. So the problem seems to me is somewhat more long-term, and the problem is this. The rhetoric coming out of the conservative wing of the LD, the more conservative wing of the LDP, represented by like people like Abe and Aso and the Nakagawa and so on, creates this impression that something big is happening that's going to lead to, I don't know what, a new militarily muscular Japan and so forth and so on. And that leads to reaction, which leads to a nationalist backlash in Japan, because Japan's not doing these things, and why is everybody beating up on it, especially the Chinese, which then reinforces the strength of those elements on the Japanese right that would like to see Japan do these things. And so we have this peculiar phenomenon that China, which has a military budget that grows by 15% or more a year and has been for the last decade and a half, is widely credited for being engaged in a peaceful rise. And Japan, which has cut back its defense spending by about a percentage point a year for the last 5 years or so, is seen to be on the threshold of a new era of militarism. Give me a break. This isn't the real world. But I think a lot of the responsibility for this impression lies with people in the LDP who talk a talk that they're not going to walk. So, you know, they talk the talk, but they're not going to walk the walk, which is good in my point of view. I mean, good that they don't walk the walk. But I don't think it makes sense to engage in a rhetoric that isn't backed up by substance and that will create unnecessary alarm outside, in the outside world, where people don't really can't read the code language within which Japanese are talking to each other about these issues.
Are there some parallels to Nakasone when he came in and everyone thought he had fangs, and in the end he ended up, you know, doing some important things with the alliance, being slightly more assertive and breaking a few minor taboos, but was incrementally changing Japanese security policy?
Yeah, in fact, I have a column I got to write today, on deadline for tonight for an American magazine. I'm not saying which one, because if I don't make the deadline, then we'll forget I mentioned this. But anyway, a major theme of this column that I'm going to write up after this, getting back to New York this afternoon, is that We don't know whether Abe is just an ideologue or whether he's a pragmatic ideologue. And the global press coverage of him so far is very reminiscent of the way the global press covered Nakasone when he first became prime minister. He was going to revise the constitution. He was going to bring nuclear weapons to Japan. He was a Gaullist who was going to put some distance between Japan and the U.S. and have a more autonomous foreign policy. And then Nakasone became prime minister. He never changed his ideology, but he understood something absolutely critical, that when you're prime minister, a cool, detached assessment of what's in the national interest has to trump your personal ideology. And when he went to Yasukuni and saw the dangers that that created for Japan's relations with China, he didn't go back. When he became prime minister, he worked out a very close relationship with Ronald Reagan and got the Americans to consider Japan in its global strategy. So at the time, the issue was the SS-20s that the Russians had appointed to Europe, and so the Europeans wanted them taken away, so they were going to turn them around and point them to Japan instead. And Nakasone got Reagan to understand that this was part of a global issue. Now, the question is Abe, he cannot be another Koizumi, but can in that sense he be another Nakasone? He's no evidence that that is in the cards, in the sense that he doesn't have the background as a sophisticated thinker on foreign affairs that Nakasone had before he became prime minister. But if he puts together a team and understands the national interest has to come ahead of personal preference, ideological preference, then he'll surprise everybody in a very positive way by being a kind of Nakasone on foreign policy. So I'm really glad you asked that.
Let me ask one more. I'm very happy because, and I look forward to the column in. Just let us know somehow. What about Kishi as a model, who in some ways his own grandfather might fit that mold?
I'm not sure, but I think Kishi weighs quite heavily on Abe's consciousness. But it's not for what Kishi did as prime minister. You know, the security treaty revision would strengthen Japan's hand, you know, eliminated a lot of the unequal treaty quality of the original security treaty. No, I think the Kishi impact on Abe is much more about the history issue and protecting the reputation of his grandfather. And I think the Kishi connection, you know, which is very powerful because it comes down through his mother, who's still very, you know, she's a very active, very formidable, very impressive lady. That impact complicates the handling of the history issue. I don't think it's that relevant to handling kind of the job of being prime minister.
Sorry, I raised it. It leans more on the ideological side than the Nakasone example, which is on the pragmatic. Byung-gi?
Kim Byung-gi, Korea University. Kim Byung-gi, Korea University, and just a 1 week visiting scholar at Georgetown. Could you just clarify, in terms of your description of Abe being rather strategic, and I mean, or lack thereof, because the way his rhetoric is so strong, and then his confidence that Korea relations will be managed, which I agree with you, because I think there's certain structural variables, you know, too much leaning on China, and you know, our leadership being confused. But then what you would describe as a good relationship between Korea and Japan, which I think what you're saying is that our leadership has to learn and to play balance of power, and thereby there would not need to be, you know, a minute effort by the Japanese leadership. precisely the point that Dr. Lee Hong-gu and I actually hosted just last week in Seoul with Jim Delaney and H.D. Johnson, former Secretary of Navy, and then Peter Varga from Defense, dealing with Homeland Security. And Dr. Lee Hong-gu, your longstanding friend, pointed out a concern, which is precisely that we didn't talk about U.S. security policy, but about Abe, precisely on the points that you worry about. And from his view, which I agree, I think there will be some really real difficulties, precisely because of the very not being like Nakasone. It's not, I mean, it could be a little bit premature, but if you look at it, it's very a bit worrying because of, in essence, that there's really not much that Japan really needs to do. It's just a balance of power politics. But if you look at it in detail, I think a personality factor will come into a lot of difficulties, both internally in Japan and in relation to Korea, which I do not want to see. Okay. See what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, we just one more thing on the Korea issue. I think that Abe will make, I don't know, this is just my guess, my hunch. I think he's going to make a pretty energetic effort to improve relations with Seoul. I imagine Seoul may be his first foreign visit. Mm. I think he wants to go there. And I think he will say a lot of positive things about relations between Korea and Japan. Again, it's not unlike Nakasone. If my memory is not wrong, I think Nakasone's first overseas visit as prime minister was to Seoul. And this year, I was at Nakasone's 88th birthday party in Tokyo a couple of months ago. And the prime minister at the time Nakasone made that visit, Chun Doo-hwan, flew over for the birthday party. And Nakasone had used that visit to bring over a big aid package to South Korea and to stress that it wasn't just the alliance with the United States that made South Korea important to Japan, but South Korea was important to Japan. I expect Abe is going to do something very, very similar. There, the wild card or the joker in the deck is whether the Korean prime minister is going to respond in a positive manner or not. Because if he thinks that playing the anti-Japan card is maybe the only ticket he has left to retaining popular support, then no matter what Abe does, is not going to work. So this may be much more a problem of Korean domestic politics than of Japanese politics.
Abe may be more like Nakasone than Nomuchun is like Chun Doo-hwan.
That's kind of a good thing, actually, but for other reasons.
Yeah, please.
Takehiko Nakao of the Embassy of Japan. And my question is, first of all, I cannot agree more to your statement that the Abe cabinet will need more policies than just attitude or style. I cannot agree more because we need a lot of things done in this very crucial moment of our history. We must change many things in a positive way. My question is, to do that, I think he needs a lot of very sound and healthy discussion with the private sector, bureaucrats, and also democratic parties. To have a healthy democracy, we need a lot of interaction between those parties. And on part of the bureaucracy, I hope that he'll encourage positive element of the bureaucracy, which are the devoted subordinates of the political leadership, and also with a lot of reform-minded elements in the bureaucracy, because the bureaucracy, especially in the central government, is not to keep the things as it is. It is needed to change things for any area. But my question is about the Democratic Party. I think it is being drifted and losing a certain focus. It looks as
you're talking about the Democratic Party here?
No.
You're talking about the Party in Japan.
In Japan. So they look more paternalistic or old-fashioned in a way. So how do you evaluate the roles and the policies of a Democratic Party?
So one of the reasons why the short to midterm future of Japanese politics is so uncertain is that The LDP isn't as strong as it looks, and the DPJ isn't as weak as it appears. The LDP looks really strong because Koizumi was so popular. He swept that election last September. The LDP didn't win that election. Koizumi won the election. And the DPJ, which lost a lot of seats, actually saw its popular vote increase in the election last September. It's just that, you know, with assassins and so on, the total vote, the voting percentage went up 6 or 7 points, I think. And they all went to these, the people who ended up being the Koizumi children. So there's a potential basic strength to the DPJ that people are underestimating. That's the good news. The bad news is that the party seems to me to sort of kind of have no energy. There are a lot of people in the DPJ who don't like Mr. Ozawa, and so they're kind of unhappy. Then you have, you know, Ozawa himself, who, you know, I've been watching Ozawa for a long time, and he has managed to mess up everything that he touched from 1993 on until he became president of the DPJ this time. And I think he has handled himself extremely well. And if he can continue to do that, and if his health is okay, I think Ozawa is going to be a very formidable competitor to Koizumi. Ozawa seems to have learned a lot of lessons from his past behavior. The most important one being that if people don't agree with, in your own party, don't agree with you all the time, it doesn't mean that they don't respect you. And you have to live with some disagreement. That's always been his great weakness, is that he wasn't able to take people who were not yes men. I think he's a much more mature leader, and I think he's become a much more sophisticated thinker about issues of foreign relations, more complicated thinker about issues of foreign relations. I think he can be a very formidable competitor. But those of us who have looked at Japanese politics for a long time have learned one thing. Never underestimate the ability of the opposition to self-destruct.
Andy, and this will be the last question.
Thank you very much, Mike and Jerry, for really fascinating comments. I think just one comment and then a question. I think the relationship between the U.S. president and Abe-san is going to be in some ways even more complex than the relationship between President Bush and Koizumi. In a way, I wish you were still in, Mike, because I think they really this is going to require all hands on deck, because he's a much more complicated set of circumstances, I believe. But on the other hand, you're here and we get to have these events, so this is very good. I think... the question I have for you after listening this morning is, how would you really define Abe-san's base? I mean, who really got Abe-san into office? It was clear that Koizumi-san was swept in by essentially the people, and the people remained his most important base. But I think Abe-san brings a much more complex pedigree. I think in many ways he started preparing for this when his father was unable to assume the prime ministership, and he's been thinking about this for an awfully long time. But he faces an enormously complicated set of circumstances, as you've described this morning. How is he going to, in a sense, thrust forward from his base, which I believe is will hold him back in many ways? And wouldn't you, as part of that, if you might just comment a bit, I believe Nakagawa Hidenao-san is enormously important in many ways, but particularly on this question, because Abe-san's going to need help to move out because the issues he faces are so complex, and the public doesn't come down cleanly on many of them at all.
Well, that's a very, insightful, good comment, I think. You know, what's his base? Well, why did he become prime? How did he become president of the LDP and prime minister? I think the key answer to that is that Koizumi's strategy for retaining power for 5 years was to shut out everybody else in the party who had a power base so that you could literally almost see their power kind of wilting on the vine. He didn't let any faction. I remember Nakasone telling me a few months after Abe became after Nakasone became prime minister, I was talking with Nakasone. He said, "You know, he has to bring in Japanese the akuto, the bad guys, into his government, or he'll never get anything done." When I was prime minister, I brought in Kanemaru Shin, and I had Gotoda Masaharu as chief cabinet secretary. I brought in the powers in the party, and that's how we got the job done. And he said, "You know, Koizumi-kun, he's not going to get anything done because unless he changes his strategy." But Koizumi had a different strategy: keep all the yuroksha, the guys with power, starve them. Don't let them near power. The result was, and then last fall, he kicked out several people who would have been key competitors for the party presidency this year. Hiranuma would have been a very formidable candidate. Noda Seiko might have become the first female prime minister of Japan this year if she hadn't been so dumb and opposed that bill, not knowing what she was leaving herself open for. So the reason Abe is prime minister is because Koizumi set the stage for his chosen person to get it. And I think it was never not much of a question that Koizumi wanted a younger person, first of all, to be prime minister. He did not think that it was desirable for anyone of his generation to succeed him. And among the younger people, there was this one. One person. And Abe's base, you know, in the party, contrary to the impression, because he got such broad support, is not very strong, and it's not very broad. And, you know, Prime Minister Mori would have much preferred to have Mr. Fukuda get the job first and then have Abe come in later. And I think a lot of Abe's friends are concerned that this was premature, that it would have been better to have someone else first, first of all, get some space between Abe and Koizumi so that you're not constantly being compared to this incomparable leader. Now, so his base is kind of shallow. It's broad and it's shallow. And his base in the public has a lot to do with his kind of standing tall, representing Japanese kind of nationalism, the issue being the North Korean abductees. That's what turned him into a real formidable candidate. So it just takes us back to where we've been all morning. This is a man who cannot use his popularity to push through policies over the opposition of his own party. He has to, in a way, play the game the old-fashioned way. Build a consensus within the LDP to adopt policies that the public will appreciate. That is a really, really tough order. And you have to hope that he's up to the task. Because if he's not, he will be gone less than a year from now. He will not survive the upper house election if they lose their majority, and the reason is that the public and the media think it's because he didn't know what he was doing and didn't do anything. He'll be gone. And if he's gone, so is the stability that we've seen in Japanese politics for the past 5.5 years. After all, we had Koizumi for 5 years, And then over the previous 10 years, you probably had a dozen or so, almost not a dozen, but a lot of prime ministers.
I think it was eight.
Was it eight?
They were all lined up in the Kante when the president went to Japan.
And if Abe fails, you might well see a repeat of that kind of revolving door, which means that nothing much gets done, and then the Koizumi legacy is really set back, because that's a system then in which there's no real direction. Everything is kind of put on autopilot. And that means real deterioration in the Koizumi legacy, I think.
Many of you may not realize this, but Professor Curtis is also an accomplished jazz musician. Is it sax?
Piano.
And one of the marks of a truly great jazz musician is that no matter how dull or mediocre the other instruments are, the virtuoso performer can go off on a riff that just dazzles the audience, which Professor Curtis just did. So I agree with Carl Green. We're going to have you back. I hope not to assess the post-Abe era, but we'll have to wait and see. Please join me in thanking Professor Jerry Curtis.
Thanks, Jerry.